ready to proceed?
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, good afternoon. May it please the court, I'd like to present my arguments this morning on behalf of my client, Andrew Brown. Today I plan to discuss the suppression issue regarding my client's spontaneous statement to the two New York City police officers, as well as the 3507 issue. Andrew Brown, age 17, was apprehended in Brooklyn, New York by a New York City fugitive task force 2 months after he was indicted for murder in this case. When he was captured at 6:30 a.m., the New York City officers contacted the Wilmington police, Officer DiClemente, and told her they had Brown in custody. She got in her car, and she drove up to Brooklyn. By the time she arrived, Brown had been in the New York City police custody for 5 hours and had not said a word about this case. Officer DiClemente then questioned him for 1.5 to 2 hours. Within minutes of the conclusion of that interrogation, Brown was turned over back over to the New York City police officers to be driven to another station for processing.
Is the questioning by the Wilmington detective in the record anywhere? Is there a transcript of that?
No, there's no transcript in the record anywhere. The fact that the length of the interrogation, the fact that there was an interrogation, it was 1.5 hours, that's in the record. The fact that she was in the room without the New York City police officers, that's in the record. The fact that it was a violation of her Sixth Amendment rights is in the record in a variety of ways, by concession of the state at the trial, by concession of the state in the brief, and by concession of the state at the last time we argued this case here on April 25th. Advised the court that they, in fact, that he was conceding that this was, in fact, a Sixth Amendment violation. So,
but as far as the nature of the questions, that's not in the record. And we do know that your motion to suppress was grounded upon a violation of Miranda and the Sixth Amendment. Is that right? Of that statement.
Actually, there were three reasons in the motion. One was the Sixth Amendment, one was the Fifth Amendment, and one was that there was a violation of their obligation to follow family court rules and try to notify the parent, because he was only 17 at the time of his arrest. But I think the case comes before this court today under the context of a conceded Sixth Amendment violation.
But the issue of voluntariness was not related to the first statement or the second statement?
The issue of voluntariness, I believe, was conceded in the first statement, that it was a Sixth Amendment violation.
No, I mean in terms of overbearing free will in that context. Was there any issue of voluntariness in, as to the first statement or the unsolicited statement?
As to the unsolicited statement, clearly no. Except in terms that it was linked to the first statement. As to the first statement, the state concedes there was a Sixth Amendment violation of his right to counsel. And that's where I believe that's the jumping off point here. He had a right to counsel at the time he was questioned.
I think Justice Richardson's question goes to the discussion that you saw by the U.S. Supreme Court case in Harris versus New York. After Miranda was decided, mm-hmm. where the state can't come in, a statement can't come in during the state's case in chief, Harris versus New York said you can use it for impeachment purposes if the defendant testifies in a manner that's inconsistent with the suppressed statement, as long as the statement that was suppressed wasn't otherwise involuntary.
I would not take issue with that.
Well, with what? Was the statement voluntary or with the statement of the law?
Having seen the statement was not a voluntary statement. I mean, he said, I think I'm entitled to an attorney here. I don't want to be talking about this. I think you need to call my mother. Those are all things that were said during the statement. Statement never made it to the record, though, because when we got to the suppression hearing, I learned for the first time that the state was conceding that there was a violation. Well, and we move directly to the next stage.
Of course, the issue here is the second statement and whether it's the fruit of the poisonous tree, and the fact that the tree was poisoned in the form of the first statement, I guess, is a conceded proposition. My question is, how are we supposed to analyze that? Is it a factual determination, a facts and circumstances determination? Is there a legal test? Specifically, if I recall correctly from the last argument, one of the points you were making was that that we should employ a but-for analysis. Under that analysis, I suppose one could make a fairly persuasive argument that but for the first statement, there wouldn't have been a second statement, because the defendant's second statement was really, you know, a continuation of the dialogue, at least in his own mind, with the detective.
That's the argument I made then. That's the argument I'm hoping to persuade the court.
Do you have a backup argument? That is, if but-for is not the test, what would be the alternative?
Well, I would say that this is a linkage test here. He made the statement within moments. The testimony was this: within 5 minutes after he's finished with DiClemente, he's brought to the New York City police officer's car. Within moments of being in the car, he then says, "She didn't know what she was talking about. I shot the victim for this reason in particular."
As I understood this aspect of your argument at our first oral argument, it's that there was not a sufficient break for it to be spontaneous. Okay.
So what I'm arguing is there was a linkage between the first and second statements. The linkage is twofold. The linkage is temporal. It occurs a very short time after the conclusion of the first one, and it's topical because he says, "When I was talking to her, she didn't know what she was talking about. The reason I shot the guy was because of this." So it's only 5 minutes later. It's based on the same subject, based upon what he told the police officers. So there's a strong linkage there. And, in fact, I would submit to the court that it's a continuation of what he was just saying. Is the fact that he's saying it to two New York City police officers who had held him in custody for 5 hours, locked in a police car with them, as opposed to locked in a small interview room with the Wilmington police officer just a few minutes early, is that the sufficient break in the chain of events? I would argue that it's not.
Would your position be any different if the facts were the same, except that the hiatus between the termination of the interview with DiClemente and the putting of the defendant in the car to be taken for booking was 30 minutes rather than 5 or 10
well,
minutes?
Well, the time certainly, there's got to be a tipping point somewhere in there. And if it's not 5 minutes, what is it? I mean, you can look at it the other way. If she had brought him to the police officers 5 seconds after she finished her statement, and she had made the statement, and he had made that statement 5 seconds afterwards, I think we would all probably agree, well, you know, 5 seconds isn't very long, and then the statement's connected. Well, now it's only 5 minutes. But clearly at some point in time, it becomes, there's a break in the chain. So how do we determine whether 5 minutes is within that continuation of the event? And my argument on this point is this. When I was arguing the suppression motion, I was trying to figure out, why would this client make this statement to the police officers? And first I thought, well, maybe these guys were questioning. Maybe they were trying to just, you know, goad him a little bit. But I got to tell you, at the suppression hearing, they were convincing, they were consistent. We didn't say a word to this guy, all right? He got in the car. As soon as he sat down in the seat, this is what he told us. But I said, why would he say such a terrible thing? And the prosecutor responded to that argument. He said, you know what? Probably because he was still fired up about the interview by DiClemente. All right. Now, if he's still fired up, I think the time that this becomes relevant is as long a period of time as he's fired up. if he's fired up 5 minutes later or 20 minutes later, a half hour later, it's still part of the same continuum. There has been no break in events.
Well, I don't think you're suggesting we use a fired up test, but is there a, let's narrow it and segment it. If it's a Fifth Amendment violation, let's assume the statement was taken without proper Miranda warnings and it's suppressed, and then he's in the car afterwards and he gives the statement. Is it simply because of that temporal connection that an unsolicited statement in the car would be suppressed because of a Miranda violation? Or should we apply a test of voluntariness to the unsolicited statement? And the reason I ask that is because the Ninth Circuit, the Sixth Circuit, the Tenth Circuit, I think, have said that if you've got a Miranda violation and then an unsolicited statement, the test is voluntariness, not the cat out of the bag,
right,
and the compulsion that might come from once the cat's out of the bag to try and correct yourself.
Well, I think one of the cases I cited on this point is the Nix case, which was the Sixth Amendment violation case. And the result, I don't think that was a voluntariness issue. It was strictly Sixth Amendment. And if there is a Sixth Amendment violation, I think the Nix court said that you put everybody back to square one. Had this Sixth Amendment not caused this subsequent statement or this subsequent problem to arise, how do you solve the problem? And it's by bringing everybody back to square one. And I don't think that it was a voluntariness test at that point. It was the but-for test. And how do you cure the but-for test? So I would go back to relying on Nix and on the Sixth Amendment analysis and say that it is a fruit of the poisonous tree type of analysis here. And then you've got to go back to how do we solve the problem because of the fruit of the poisonous tree. And in that situation, I would submit that the second statement has to be suppressed.
Mr. Capone, is the record clear that the two New York City police officers in the vehicle knew or did not know that Brown had just come from an interrogation by a Wilmington police officer? And secondly, if they knew he had just come from an interrogation, did they know that he had asserted his right to counsel at that interrogation?
Okay, I think I can answer both of those questions. In terms of whether they knew that he had just been interrogated, yes. If you look at Appendix 823 and 826, I think they both testified that we brought him to the room, we showed her the room that she was going to be questioning him in, we left them in the room together, and then we stepped outside for that hour and a half and 2 hours. So I think the strong implication is they knew that he was in there being interrogated. As to the next question of whether or not they knew that he waived, was that the next
that he asserted his right to counsel?
That he asserted his right to counsel?
Yeah, I'm not thinking Miranda violation as in they didn't give him his Miranda rights. I'm thinking Sixth Amendment, he asserted a right to counsel.
Okay. The record's not clear on that. However, what was interesting in this case was why, because I asked them, why didn't you fellas question him? And they said, we don't do that because we knew that there was at least a warrant for his arrest and perhaps an indictment, and we know that he's got a right to counsel at that point. We don't even question him in New York State under those circumstances. So we don't even get to the point where we find out whether he's going to assert the right. Our policy is if he's under warrant or if there's under indictment, we don't ask those questions.
So in their minds, it's clearly still in custody, but they were not about to conduct an interrogation.
That's the way they answered that question.
We have the Ellison versus State case, which seems to suggest that Delaware doesn't adopt a but-for type of test under these circumstances, but that we're supposed to look at the circumstances to determine whether, if we apply the exclusionary rule, we, under those circumstances, would advance its underlying purpose, and that is to deter unlawful conduct by law enforcement officials and prevent the admission of illegally obtained evidence. Now, if that is our law as of this moment, how does it apply to the facts of this case?
That's a that's a good question, and I want to answer that. And if I could just give you a little
I want you to answer it even more than you want to answer it.
The first time I was here on April 25th, I was asked, because I came out a little stronger, I thought, about the egregiousness argument, and I went back and I listened to the tapes, and I go, what were they trying to tell me? And I go back and I figured, I think they were telling me to tone it down, but maybe I'm wrong. But so the first time I was here, I was saying, this was pretty egregious in my mind. Not only was there a Sixth Amendment violation, there was a Fifth Amendment violation, and there was the family court issue that Shamu was a juvenile. She went up there and she violated a myriad of his constitutional rights. And without, you know, she must have been aware of them. She just went ahead and did it. And I tried to contrast that to the New York City police officers who said, you know, we don't question juveniles. We don't question people under warrant or indictment. We have a hands-off policy on this guy. And so she goes up there and violates his rights. And then if that hadn't happened, there's no question that this second statement would not have been made. So I felt, and I argued the last time perhaps more strongly than I argued today, was that this was a pretty egregious situation, the way it occurred. And therefore, that assisted my argument that this second statement should have been suppressed.
Well, let's say we're not going to call it a fired-up test, but let's say rather than a but-for test under circumstances that you've just described, what the Delaware rule should be is that if there is a proximate cause relationship between the tainted interrogation and a temporally short voluntary statement, if that voluntary statement was foreseeable given the circumstances, does it have any impact on the application of the exclusionary rule?
Well,
because it doesn't involve any actual affirmative conduct on the part here of the two New York City police officers.
If it was foreseeable.
Let me be a little clearer. What I'm trying to do is understand what Ellison versus State means when it says we're to look to the circumstances to determine whether or not the exclusionary rule's underlying policy is advanced by saying that his voluntary statement to the New York City police officers should be suppressed. And if a but-for test doesn't work, if it's not but-for the taint and his assertion of his right to counsel before De Clemente, and because it's human nature for him to try to correct that, one could argue, in a temporally short period of time if she got it all wrong, how do we analyze the circumstances for purpose of application of the exclusionary rules policy?
I think that you could analyze it as a continuation of the statement. And if it's a continuation of the statement, it's close in time.
Did she walk him to the car and put him in the car? I thought I caught that from something you said, but I don't remember it from the facts.
She was outside. I asked one of the officers that. She was outside. I said, how close was she to the car? He goes, I can't remember, but she was outside when he got in the car. He was held in the room for just a few minutes while they were getting ready to take him. She was outside, and he was outside when they got into the car. That's the best answer I can give you on that subject.
Can I try and clarify another fact that perhaps is important here? The original 1.5 to 2 hour interrogation by Officer De Clemente, am I correct in understanding that he did not, during that interrogation, admit anything?
He didn't directly admit to the murder, but
he said something that suggested he knew a little bit about what had happened. Okay.
That's correct.
But what I'm getting at is, to the extent that we're trying to analyze the impact of his voluntary statement in the police car when he was not being questioned, and you're making the argument that this is a continuation of the interrogation that he had just a few minutes before concluded, that would be a stronger argument if during that earlier interrogation the officer had said, you know, what did you do? What happened? he said, I'm not answering that, but she said, well, isn't it true that you did this or did that? And he says, no, I did this, I did something else. And then he gets in the car and says, she had it all wrong. She thought that I did this and that and the other thing. Here's what I really did. But if during the earlier inappropriate interrogation he hadn't said anything about what he had done, is it appropriate for us to be making the jump, if you will, of saying now he gets in the police car, now all of a sudden he wants to explain something to correct a misstatement, if you will, from that earlier interrogation? He wasn't correcting anything, was he?
Well, I think he was, because she was the way she phrased, and these were the last questions she asked him in that statement, was, you shot him because he wasn't complying with you. She was using the word complying. And you got to remember that this is a 17-year-old kid, and although he's had problems with the law before, believe me, he's none too bright. She's saying, the reason why you shot him was he wasn't complying with you, wasn't complying with you. And he said, you know, no, that's not it. You haven't got that right. She concludes the interview, and then just 5 minutes later, he's saying, the reason I shot him was he wasn't moving fast enough. That's what she did. And it, so that, in my mind, that was a continuation of the interrogation. But the interrogation had stopped, and now he was locked in a car with these two other New York officers who'd had him in custody now for, at this point, over 6.5 hours. But I get back to the first part. He'd been in their custody for 5 hours before she arrived on the scene. He didn't say a word about this case during that time. If she hadn't come to the, if she hadn't driven to Brooklyn and put him in that room, this wouldn't happen at all.
Yeah, we understand that your but-for point,
all right, up there,
and the continuation of the interview may be just another verbal formulation of that same concept. But the Chief Justice's question, you know, which really goes to my earlier question, is if we were not to employ a but-for test, what other analysis or form of analysis could we use? And the Chief Justice's question then raised the issue of Ellison versus State. When you responded to his question, that is, how we would apply the rationale of Ellison to these facts, where I thought you were going was that because the admitted Sixth Amendment violation from the first interview, from the interview, was so egregious that where there is any doubt as to whether or not the second, the spontaneous statement was voluntary or the fruit of the poisonous tree, those doubts should be resolved in favor of the defendant. Is that where you were going?
That's where I was going. That's the argument I made in stronger fashion on the 25th, and certainly in my briefs, that's what I think I made that argument in the brief.
That's how you would apply Ellison.
I guess I'm saying is the police shouldn't be rewarded for a pretty blatant and multiple violation of a person's constitutional rights. That's really what I feel.
Even though it wasn't the latter two police officers' conduct that precipitated.
That's true.
There's no way to tell them, don't you ever do this again, because that's unlawful police conduct that we cannot tolerate, because they really didn't do anything.
You're absolutely right.
The real issue is, did they have an affirmative duty, knowing that he'd just come from an interrogation no less than 5 minutes ago, to make sure to warn him not to say anything if they found out or knew that he had asserted his right to counsel during that interrogation?
Well, you could answer that question different ways depending on who your defendant is. And let's go back to the fact that this defendant is 17 years old. And under Delaware law, she was obligated to try and contact an adult to get permission to speak to him. All right? Under Delaware law, if he's under indictment already, she's got to bring him before a presenting magistrate as quickly as possible under the circumstances. Here she chose to question him for an hour and a half. So under these particular facts, I think that perhaps something like that might have been appropriate. You know what? You're not with her anymore. Do not discuss the case. We're not going to hear it. We're just driving you someplace. This was a surprise to them, I'm sure. It was But on the other hand, the fact is, because he was still in his mind fired up about what had just gone on, he was still ruminating about what was said, he continued his discussion of the interrogation into the police car.
Thank you, Mr. Capone.
Do I have any? No. I missed the 35 or 7. Did I run out of time? Am I out of time?
Yeah, we'll take your brief as your rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
If it pleases the court, good afternoon. Regarding the Sixth Amendment issue, at the suppression hearing or and during the trial, the state conceded, as Mr. Capone mentioned, that there had been a Sixth Amendment violation because the defendant had been indicted between the time of the crime and the time he was arrested in New York. And so we had no intention of using whatever he had said to Detective DiClemente because of the Sixth Amendment, what was perceived as the Sixth Amendment violation. And so we went right to his statement to the two New York police officers that he made after DiClemente's interrogation. Our position was, and it's a position that Superior Court judge accepted, was that statement was a spontaneous utterance, unrelated except in a strictly but-for way, and I'll certainly concede that had DiClemente not spoken to him, he would have nothing to say to the New York police officers. There was enough of a break, according to the trial judge. That is, he's no longer in the custody of Wilmington police. He's with the New York cops, and the New York cops know absolutely nothing about the crime. They know absolutely nothing about the interrogation. They know there was an interrogation. They know nothing more. As far as his status as a juvenile, they aren't even unaware that in Delaware he was a juvenile because in New York he's considered an adult at age of 17.
Well, the record doesn't show that they testified. We know nothing about interrogations or what occurs during an interrogation. We've never heard of Miranda. We know nothing about the possibility that he may have asserted a right to counsel. None of that's true.
They're not specifically. They're saying they turn him over. They showed, as Mr. Capone said, they showed the commander, here's the room, and then they went away. And then when it was time for them to do their fugitive squad duties.
We can conclude that at minimum they knew that he had just come from an interrogation.
Yes. Definitely. They knew he was being questioned by Detective DiClemente. It was the whole point of calling Detective DiClemente to come up. And notifying Wilmington that they had made the arrest for them to start the process. So they knew there had been an interrogation. As they testified to at the trial, they put him in the car, started driving him from the precinct to central booking, and all of a sudden he just blurts this out. He says that the Wilmington cop doesn't know what she's talking about. And I should say that Detective DiClemente, before the interrogation, had, in the course of interviewing various witnesses, interviewed the defendant's girlfriend, Yolanda Boyd, to whom he had confessed shortly after the killing. And according to Boyd's statement to DiClemente, what the defendant said was he had shot this person whom he did not know because he told him to undress and he refused. So that's where DiClemente comes up with that. She gets that from Boyd.
That statement, the Boyd statement, was introduced into evidence at the trial?
Yes. She was called as a witness, again, a reluctant witness by the time of trial, but her statement to DiClemente was introduced into evidence. Her statement to DiClemente, recounting what the defendant had told her shortly after the shooting, was introduced into evidence.
That was a videotape statement? Well, not that it makes any particular difference, but the jury saw her testify in a sense.
I know the Ruth Ann and Joanne Brown statements were videotaped. I simply cannot recall what the Yolanda Boyd's was. I'm going to assume probably was because everybody else's was videotaped.
That's why I asked.
I'm just not absolutely certain at this point. But... again, he's in the car. He just blurts this out to two individuals who happen to be, one happens to be a New York cop, the other happens to be a United States Marshal, who have absolutely no interest in the case whatsoever. The reaction of the New York police officer as soon as he hears this, I think is interesting, and showing his lack of interest, is that he basically tells the defendant to shut up. He says, you realize, of course, I'm an NYPD detective. In other words, yo, I'm not your buddy, fella. And of course, he doesn't turn around and take him back to the precinct. He keeps on going to central booking. No, I'm sure both of them were not too particularly pleased to have become witnesses in the case. But of course, that makes their, again, testimony at trial all the more believable because they have absolutely no interest in the case whatsoever, so they're very credible witnesses. I say that because at the last argument I was asked whether this could be harmless error in light of the defendant's earlier confession to Yolante Boyd, and I said at the time no, and I'm going to stick with that. Of course, obviously, the court's not bound by my estimation of the harmlessness of any error, but this pretty good confession made in the presence of two totally disinterested law enforcement officers. It just doesn't get any more credible than that. And I'd have to say that.
And you're sure disinterested law enforcement officers is not an oxymoron?
Disinterested and uninterested, both. Again, I'm sure when they heard that, they both heaved a sigh. Oh, dear, we get a subpoena. But
is there anything in the first statement to encourage or nudge the defendant to speak to these officers, such as if there's anything you told me you want to correct or anything you told, this is the Wilmington detective speaking, or you didn't say that you want to say, and I'm not there, tell these officers. We don't have the first statement. How did it end? We're done?
I will agree with Mr. Capone. The connection between the two statements is that he's probably fired up. I too have looked at the statement, and Mr. Brown is nothing if not a motor mouth. His mouth was still going when he got in the police car.
Well, was there anything to urge him to continue talking to these officers?
Or to
call her back or to keep an ongoing discussion?
No, DiComandi was done with him. She was getting nowhere with him, except to get his show of what a tough guy he is. That's basically what the conversation was about. And this, I will say that his tough guy, this is what a tough guy I am, continued on into the car. Here's what a tough guy I am. I'm going to tell you two New York cops what a tough guy I am.
Well,
that decommit, yes.
With respect to the way the interrogation ended, Mr. Capone suggested that the last thing that happened was that Officer DiClemente said, so you shot him because he wouldn't comply, right? And he said no or didn't answer or whatever, and that was the end. That's it. No, I'm done with you. No, nothing. He goes from that last question into the police car. Is that somewhere in the record, or is that, you know, can you confirm that that's the way the interrogation ended?
No, it's not in the record, and it is not. I did read the confession a while ago, and I cannot, if I had refreshed my recollection of the ending of that, I could either agree or disagree, but I can't. I just don't remember how the interrogation ended or the whatever happened in that room ended, whatever you want to call it.
Well, arguably, it would be pretty significant if the interrogation ended on a question, so this is why you shot him, isn't it? And then a few minutes later, he gets in the police car and says, no, that's not why I shot him, because, you know, the continuation aspect of it, the argument that's being made, would be supported by him just at the very end had been asked exactly that question or suggested that that's the correct state of facts, no tying up, no finishing up the interview, no, you know, I'll see you in court, no nothing, and then he's in a police car and says, well, now I got one more thing to say. But we don't know any of that because we don't have the record.
Yeah. Well, certainly I will say, yes, this is true. Along those lines, I will say certainly if he had said that to a police officer with some knowledge of what went on in the interrogation room, there would be, I think that would be a valid point. These police officers were nobody. They could have been somebody on the street.
Well, let's go back a minute to Justice Berger's question about the absence of a record. If I understand correctly, there's no record of what was said in the interrogation room because the state conceded that that statement wasn't coming in, so there's no suppression hearing in regard
right.
to it.
Yes, sir.
Is there a police report in which DiClemente relates what occurred during the interrogation? And if so, was that police report, to the extent it has any of the kind of information that Justice Berger suggested may be important, was that police report given to the defense?
Oh, I believe a transcript of the entire interrogation was given to the defense. I mean, Mr. Capone has read it.
So there is a transcript.
Oh, yes, definitely.
It's just not part of the Superior Court record.
That is correct. There is a transcript of the interrogation, the entire interrogation, not redacted or anything. It's just the entire thing, the raw transcript of the entire interrogation. It was never entered into evidence. So that is, even though it's not in evidence, it is in existence.
So to the extent this linkage argument has merit or carries any weight, it would at least have been part of a suppression hearing on the statement made to the New York police officer and the U.S. Marshal. But it wasn't introduced.
It was never introduced. No. No. I'm thinking it probably should have been. It would have been certainly helpful, not only to Superior Court, but also to this court, to see what was said. Mr. Ngozi.
Well, we can assume, can't we, that the side that would have wanted to prove the linkage to support suppression of the second voluntary statement, had it been helpful, would have introduced it. Yeah. And the fact that it's not in the record suggests that it's not helpful.
Not helpful, yes. Certainly if there is a linkage, again, the linkage that Mr. Capone pointed out, I think, and the one that he's hanging his hat on, is the he's fired up. And I will certainly concede that. I think we can both agree from the statement that he made to the officers that during the course of the interrogation, at some point, and Mr. Capone says that it was at the end. I don't recall.
Well, if he's fired up and that's clear at the end of the interrogation when DiClemente, in effect, turns him over to the other law enforcement officers, is it foreseeable that he might continue to
I would say no, it's not the foreseeability in the sense that DiClemente is thinking, oh, I've got him fired up now. Since I violated the Sixth Amendment rights and I can't use the statement I don't think DiClemente knows that.
But if they left the interrogation under the circumstances that Justice Berger's hypothetical question suggested, is it foreseeable or unforeseeable that in the short period of time during which 5 minutes, let's say, because that's all I've heard today, that he's delivered from the Wilmington police officer to the New York police officer and the U.S. Marshal, that he, given the circumstances, given his age, might say something in derogation of his assertion of his right to counsel?
No, I have to say it is not.
Well, under Ellison versus State, how are we, put aside the but-for test that case seems to reject, how are we to analyze the circumstances under which we address the second statement for the purpose of application of the exclusionary rule?
Right. Well, I think Wong Son test is exploitation of the primary illegality, and I think everyone can agree here there is no exploitation of the primary illegality. The two officers in the car do nothing. They are simply listening posts. A problem that comes up very often that Justice Ridgely hit on was the situation where a defendant confesses, and then that confession for Miranda violation or whatever is excluded, but then later is Mirandized and says it again, and that's the, oh, well, the cat's out of the bag problem. And that's not the situation here. In other words, I'll confess again, but I might as well because I've already confessed once. That's not the situation here. He did not confess. And also, he has to, I think it's interesting, he has to explain to these police officers the context of what he's about to say. He said he has to tell them what DiClemente told him. He has to tell them that he shot somebody. He has to tell them the reason DiClemente gave was not quite the right one. He has to explain all this stuff to the police officer. He's not clarifying anything. He's not clarifying anything he said, certainly, as Superior Court Judge pointed out. He's talking about something DiClemente told him.
Is there any meaningful distinction between a situation where someone is not given their Miranda rights and they say X, and then they're Mirandized later and they say Y, and a situation where someone's under indictment, is a 17-year-old, asserts the right to counsel, and then, despite having asserted the right to counsel, in the presence of law enforcement officers, makes a statement voluntarily that's tantamount to a confession?
Well, his Sixth Amendment right to counsel as a test, I don't believe he ever actually said, I want to see a lawyer. No, if anything, the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, the attachment via an indictment only, the Sixth Amendment right to counsel attaching via indictment, I think, is probably, at least under the analysis of Patterson versus Illinois, that can be cured by the reading of Miranda warnings. So I can't see that the attachment of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel via indictment only without actually retaining a lawyer or without asserting the right to counsel holds more weight than failure to read Miranda warnings, which, of course, also includes the all-important right to remain silent in addition to the right to consult with counsel under the Fifth Amendment. I would say the more egregious violation would be the failure to read Miranda.
So what is the proper test? Is it just voluntariness for the unsolicited statement, or is it something more complex?
Well, certainly voluntariness always plays a role. Even before the exclusionary rule, involuntary confessions were excluded because they simply weren't reliable and were irrelevant. Voluntariness is the groundwork, as the bedrock, and there's simply no indication here that anything he said, either to DiClemente and certainly not to the two police officers, was in any way, shape, or form involuntary. It may have been in violation of his Sixth Amendment rights because he had been indicted, but nobody was twisting his arm, nobody was beating him up, nobody was threatening him.
Did he not tell DiClemente that he did not want to talk to her?
That's a difficult call. Again, he was... All I can say really is that he had just seen too many Jimmy Cagney movies, and his
he wouldn't even know who Jimmy Cagney was, would he? At 17,
he had seen the equivalent.
I barely know who Jimmy Cagney was.
Seen the equivalent, the modern equivalent, where he's simply Mr. Tough Guy. Now I don't have any segments. Said you coppers, you're not going to get anything out of me, and on and on and on. Now whether he's asserting his right or not asserting his right, I don't know. Eventually, he just goes on and chats, and he chats for an hour and a half, so he certainly didn't want to stay silent.
But we have at least one case where someone said they wanted to talk to their mother, and we said that was an assertion of a right to remain silent. Why would the equivalent of, I don't want to talk to you, not be sufficient?
Well, it's a judgment call. Whether when at the one moment you say, I'm not going to say anything to you, and then you keep on talking, I don't know what to make of that. It's not as not quite as clear cut as Mr. Pollan makes it seem, whether he's deserted to write his silence or not. I'm pretty sure he never said he wanted to see an attorney.
Are any of Mr. Capone's comments about the way in which Delaware's law operates in regard to juveniles important in this case? Is there any significance that he's 17? Is there any significance that he didn't have a parent or a legal guardian present when he was questioned? Any of those points significant in your view?
The fact that he's 17, I think, makes his status as a Delaware juvenile less compelling. Were he 13 or 14, that would be something else. But again, because there was no suppression hearing regarding DiClemente's statement, we don't know what steps DiClemente took to comply with the notification requirements. He did at the time, have a mother, and DiClemente knew how to get in touch with his mother. So, in all likelihood, she tried, and the mother simply refused to go up to New York and be with her. But again, because there was no suppression hearing regarding the DiClemente statement, that's not on the record. We do know, however, that the mother was not with him. For what reason, we don't know. We do know also that in New York, he was not a juvenile. He was an adult, so that was an adult arrest. But certainly, to the extent there's any conflict of law, since DiClemente was going to prosecute the case in Delaware, she should have complied with Delaware law, despite the fact that she's in New York, where the laws are different. But again, we don't know whether she did or not. If the court would like me to address the 3507, I should not, since my worthy opponent, Mr. Capone, did not get a chance to. If the court has any questions about it, I just say in the transcript of the various protestations that the two witnesses were forced to make their statements, the name Anthony and Roundtree come up. And then at page, DiClemente at page A115 identifies a detective, Anthony Roundtree, who accompanied Joanne Brown to the police station to make the statement. And on page A92, Ruth Ann Clark identifies Roundtree as a friend of Joanne. So I think this idea of threats and being forced to make statements and being forced with incarceration to make the statement kind of evaporates when we find out that the officer, Anthony Roundtree, is a friend of the family kind of person. So, sure, I mean, the murder took place in a no-snitch zone like Philadelphia, and certainly there's a great deal of pressure from the community not to cooperate and not to be a witness, and certainly the police have to exert a little bit of persuasion to get witnesses to cooperate and especially make videotape statements. This is just realistic. This is the way it is. But
speaking of realistic, would you refresh my recollection about the purpose of the material witness statute?
When I
understood that the threat was you'll go to jail if you don't give a statement because we can hold you as a material witness. Is the purpose of the material witness statute to be used to suggest to people that if you don't give a statement because we think you're a material witness, we'll put you in jail for failure to give a statement?
Nobody ever did that. There is no testimony that I saw that anyone ever threatened them to hold them as a material witness if they failed to make a statement. There's Anthony Roundtree, apparently, who was a friend of Joanne's, persuaded both Joanne and Ruvan to come in and make videotape statements. They had already made statements to police officers. I mean, that's shortly after the shooting and the.
But they didn't
want to make the videotape statement.
This whole business of if you don't give a statement, we can put you in jail is just made out of whole cloth.
As far as I can tell, yes. I don't see where it actually took place. I mean, they were both, when they came into court, they put on good shows. But I just don't see from reading this. I mean, they were very vague on these threats that they got to, that they had. They both agreed that DiClemente said nothing to them. And there's certainly nothing on the videotapes to indicate that there was any kind of coercion on the part of DiClemente. And as we pointed out, Ruth Ann Clark is the one who called the Wilmington police and arranged to come in and talk to Detective Dion, I think. And So by the time they came into court, of course, they were there under the worst kind of protestations, and the police had done everything terrible to them until Ruth Ann Clark let slip that the horrible police officer, this Anthony or Roundtree, is actually a friend of Joanne's. And, that's why I'm saying this whole business of the police were laying terrible threats on us to do this and our statements were involuntary. I, in my mind, anyhow, looking over this transcript, just evaporates. I mean, this is just made-up stuff. Sure, I'm sure friend Anthony Roundtree did tell him, look, please, you know, go in, make the statement. And as a matter of fact, at one point, Joanne says that her threats were coming from Ruth Ann. I don't know. Thank you.
No more time. You're out of time. Unless somebody added some since the last time I told you you were out of time. I don't think. Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.